Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. July 28, 2021. New Life 1312. How to establish good communication between parents and their adolescent children.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the New Life Show with Dr. Michael Leitman. Hello, Dr. Leitman.
Hello, hello.
Hello, Nitza Mazoz.
Hello.
And today we'd like to talk about communication in a family with adolescents or teenagers. We know that communication in a family is something that's not that simple, especially when the kids become teenagers. So this is what we're going to talk about today. Nitza, please.
Yeah,
communication in a family is not a simple matter. All the more when our children, when they were little, there was good communication. Somehow they listen to us, to our opinions, and suddenly they're moving. They're shifting into adolescence, and our communication's changing. And this is a very serious challenge, both for the teenagers themselves and also the parents that don't really know how to reach some kind of contact, communication, talk, how to talk to them, how to relate to each and every situation. So the first question is, what is the best possible kind of communication that a parent can expect in a phase where his children are advancing and are crossing into, or that they're at the ages of adolescence, or from the ages of, suppose, 11, 12, and until they're about 18, Dr. Leitman. I'm talking from the point of view of the wisdom of Kabbalah. Each of us is an egoist. And in communication between us, not with children, but between us, each of us, if he wants to communicate with someone else, he has to adapt himself to that other person, and the other person has to adapt himself too. So, because each has his own state, condition, perception, inclination, mood, worldview, all these particular parameters, this is one thing, and also the person. But if they want to communicate, they need to feel the state of the other person. And each of them has to at least somewhat restrict himself, what he feels, wants, expects, and to adapt himself, adjust himself to the other person. And this is how usually, or what usually people do as much as possible. The question is, can we demand such? Really? I'm approaching the problem very directly. First of all, how do children understand altogether that in our day-to-day communication with other people, we have to adjust ourselves, adapt ourselves to others, that it is mandatory, since we're human beings, we're not a part of, you know, pack of wolves, even though that they have good communication there. And besides, that we need to also give the children an example of how do we adapt ourselves to each other. And this is something that has to be done very clearly and I'd say conspicuous, raging, screaming way, shouting way, that the children see that dad disagrees with mom, but he tells them quietly,
I disagree with her, but I have to adjust myself, adapt myself to her, he tells them quietly. And then he does it. Well, a bit in an exaggerated way for the children to understand what he's doing. But this is the example that children eventually understand, and you have to explain to them that a family is the connection between several people, and the connection is built on concessions. That's the main thing. That's the magical word, concession. That there can be no concession toward each other unless each annuls himself toward the other person. And then there's connection between them. Otherwise, there is no connection. There is some kind of a natural compatibility, or that it is worthwhile for them to do because of different conditions, goals that are beyond them. But it's beneficial that as a result, I'll succeed, I'll gain, otherwise I can't. Like we do when we connect with some stranger or at a place of work. But really, a good connection in the family, proper connection, has to be built on that we understand that we are going, each of us, to pay for it with our ego. And I am willing to make this sacrifice in order to be in this connection, because if we really make an effort to see what goes on inside the connection, we gain more than we lose. That's it. So what you said is that, first of all, what we have to understand and also communicate it to the teenager is that there has to be some kind of compatibility between us, because adjustment or suitability, because that's the basic condition for it. And now there's also some principle that's different than the common approach, because nowadays the common approach is to show teenagers in general that there's a consent between parents, not to, make the disagreement stand out, but, you know, you're saying to show them an example, and it is the opposite example to what we're used to, Dr. Latham. Even the opposite. You have to, like, act this out before them, like in a theater, that we disagree, that we're in strife, and we don't understand each other, and each of them explains to the children how much he does not understand what the other demands for the children to see it. And afterwards, we show them an example of how each of us overcomes and is in connection with the other. Nitsa. So if up till now the direction was to hide the disagreements between the parents, Dr. Latham, depends until what age. Nitsa, what age, Dr. Latham, depends very much on the family. I can't exactly say. But nonetheless, you have to start relating to them as the grown-ups, for them to learn from it. And so they will take into account our attitude toward them, that we even consult them, that we talk to them, seek their advice. They're truly as family members, not all the time as children, that we tell them, shut up. Nitsa. By showing that we're in disagreement, and we're not talking about young children, they're 13, 14, what does that build in them when on the one hand they encounter some kind of disagreement and our ability to overcome it? Dr. Lightman, it builds a behavioral pattern in them. Nitsa, that says what? That there are disagreements appearing between us, Dr. Lakeman, all the time, Nitza, and it's natural and okay. And upon that, Dr. Lakeman, we have to reach agreement, some kind of completion. Nitza, so we're all the time leading in that direction, and in this way, I'll ask, what happens when there is a disagreement between the teenagers and their parents? Is it something that they also learn from? Dr. Lakeman, of course. Of course. Nitza, and what implications does it have? Dr. Lakeman, so they see examples about what happens between the parents, and also when I have a problem with one of the children in the family, then I can talk to him. Really, almost as equals. I can also talk to this about this to the other children. Depends about what, of course, but it could be something gentle, you know, subtle. And this is how we come to a state where there's nothing to hide between us, but to the contrary, all of us understand our nature, our conditions, and we're aware of them. And that's how we advance in life. And at least the pattern that exists in the family, we later have to see how they carry it on in their families, at their place of work, etc. Okay, let's see, how does this pattern, Dr. Lightman, I just want to point out one principle. What I want to happen in the life of each and every child when he grows up and builds his family, I have to give him clear examples from our family about it. Nitza, so anything that he can learn about the connection between us, the parents' attitude toward each other, all of these kinds of connections is something that will later on build in him the ability to build his ties. Dr. Lakeman, yeah, it is an example that he won't be able to leave. It's above him. What he absorbs in the family during childhood, it remains. Dr. Lakeman, as it says, raise a child in his own ways, Owen, because this will accompany him his entire life. Now, a question that I'm getting now online, are there fixed or permanent actions that we have to do in the family, like having workshops in order to solve problems? Should it be a part of the family routine, Dr. Lightman? It depends on the parents, to what measure do they understand what needs to be done, and what communication do they already have with the children? The truth is that we can have workshops about it and give explanations, like with Nitza, like with other psychologists. So I think that it's good. Well, now suppose parents went through such training and they start getting this integral point of view about things. Should they introduce workshops at home with teenagers as a part of their day-to-day life? Dr. Lakeman, again, if the parents are ready and they feel that confident that that's correct, then of course. Oh, and how do you teach teenagers to deal with their eruptions of anger, etc.? Dr. Lakeman, example. Again, there's no more than an example. You have to show the children how angry you are at someone in the family, and afterwards to show them how you calm yourself down forcefully. Not that you forgot about it over time, that, you know, you simply forget about it, but that you forcefully calm yourself down and you show that to them, And you even turn to someone that you got mad at and maybe even ask for forgiveness. For example, it is very common nowadays when teenagers are angry, and you know it happens plenty of times. They're angry at the world, at their parents, at many things, teenagers. And usually, you know, the parents try to encourage the children to explain what happened, why are you angry, for me understand something else, Dr. Layton. Only an example. Nitsa, no point in getting into a discussion with a teenager, why are you angry, Dr. Layton. He doesn't, or she, they don't even want to say why. I'm not demanding of them to open their heart. Maybe it's hard for them. And how come it's something that I'm asking them to do? Oh, and what then, Dr. Lightman? To simply give an example of how to calm down and properly arrange the relations and go back to the orders of life. Oh, and next question, a follow-up on the previous question about eruptions and anger. What do you do in a situation where the teenager, he slams the door and leaves, yells and leaves. What does the parent do now, Dr. Lake? Nothing? Nothing. Doesn't do anything. As if nothing happened. And after some time, when the child comes back, when life goes on, after 2 or 3 or even days or even a week, then if there's an opportunity to sit down together, the parent says that nonetheless he'd like to scrutinize that situation, you know, calmly. Nitsa, and then what? He does ask what caused the teenager to erupt, Dr. Layton. No, he can't ask. But this is something that you have to adjust the conversation and the situation and do all these things. Maybe it's not the same parent that supposed the outburst of anger was toward the father, so maybe the mother does it, has this talk, softening things, asking about it in a way. Oh, and in the presence of the other parent, Dr. Light, yeah, even that way. Oh, and another question. What is the purpose of education at the age of adolescents as opposed to when they were children? What is the big goal of raising teenagers, Dr. Lightman? Giving youth examples for proper behavior inside the family. Such examples, actually. According to the example, does he act? Altogether, we activate ourselves according to such examples, like pictures. You know, such a picture. Accordingly, we behave, act. Oh, and all life long, Dr. Leibman. Yeah, every time we enter a new frame. Oh, and another question. What is the role of the mother? And what is the role of the father when educating teenagers? Dr. Layton, they have to be connected, not to show that they're so connected to the children that each of them can also take the side of the other person. Oh, and I don't understand, Dr. Layton. Not that mom and dad always have the same opinion, but each of them can also accept the opinion of the child, adolescent, and not that because he's a parent, then he already identifies with the other person automatically, with the other parent automatically. Owen, does the mom and dad have specific roles when children are growing up, when they're teenagers, Dr. Leitman? It's very flexible, I can't say, in relation to boys, to girls, some period and childhood, I don't know.
Okay.
They'll understand it themselves.
Mitzah,
what will cause them to feel that this parent is there for them 100%? Because it's really a feeling that the teenager is really lacking. Dr. Lightman, I don't know how to insert it into the awareness, into the family, that the entire family exists so that the children will grow up successfully. Not even, you know, correctly, but successfully. This is something that they have to feel, that all in all, this is what the parents want. So if we as parents give the teenagers this feeling all the time that we want for them to grow up successfully, to be successful, then it also builds this feeling that they can trust us, that we're there for them, that they can trust us, because many times, specifically this that is flawed, there's a feeling that I can't exactly trust my parents. Dr. Layton, no. Here I think that the parents need to try to build, along with everything that goes on in the family, to try and build, build some kind of that the mom and dad, they have a strong word about the direction of that teenager in life. In my family, that was for sure with my son and also both the girls. Owen, is it possible to build a good communication with the child when he becomes a teenager? And if so, how? Dr. Light, first of all, not to sit on the child's head, not to suffocate him. Not by hugs and not by, not with handcuffs. That's one thing. To the measure to which the child wants to be in connection with you, you're in connection with him. He has to know that you're always accessible. But usually, the approach has to come from him. There have to be specific days for each and every child, and maybe even hours in those days, where it is common for them to connect to their mom and dad, wherever they are. Contact them wherever they are. And this way to try to somehow, nonetheless, influence their life. And, in any way that you can. Owen, how do parents create a situation where they can give the teenagers, their teenage kids, the direction in life? Dr. Lightman, they have to feel that we as parents are giving them almost unlimited freedom. Up to a certain limit, and when it so happens that they are trespassing that boundary, then the parent can get up and show his force, all the habits that he has inserted in the child, in the adolescent, and now it's already maybe a teenager, and he can determine his approach to the child's life. The child could be 20 plus. That nonetheless, this is what the parent leaves for himself for times of trouble, so to speak, for difficult times, but then he gets up and takes the reins into his hands. Nitsa, what will give them confidence? What will give teenagers confidence, Dr. Lightman, that they know that their parents standing behind them and that they have a home, which is also a haven, which is a warm corner for them. And this is something that's left in them for life. Nonetheless, as much as the parents are demanding several basic things from them, not to change direction in life from, you know, like, there are many things that go on nowadays, like children know. Nonetheless, children have to consult their parents in relation to important principal matters, but this is what they have to know, that they have that corner, mom's home, dad's home, however they want to call it, and they can come and always get a warm approach, attitude. Oh, and what is the dominant feeling that I want to create as a parent with my teenage child? Dr. Lightman, inner connection. That a child that was in the family nest, this is how he has to feel, that this place, this connection is left and does not disappear. Oh, and Dr. Lightman, thank you very much. Dr. Lightman, good luck. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.
Meals in the temple. Comment. We know from history that they not only sacrificed animals in the temple, but also they arranged large meals there. My response. The fact is that the temple was also a place for studying, where people from all over the country gathered. When a person would come to the temple, he had to bring sacrifices with him, and some of them were used to prepare food. These dishes were placed on common tables and anyone could come and take part in the meal. A Kabbalistic meal is usually attended by those who, with its help, want to ascend spiritually. They understand what they are coming together for. It is huge internal work, a great effort. From Kab TV's Spiritual States, July 9, 2021. The 15th of Av, the day when life begins. The 15th of Av is a special holiday called the Day of Love because love is the ultimate goal of our corrections. It is said that there has never been a happier and better day than this. And we are not talking about earthly love between a man and a woman. This is the day of everyone's love for everyone and for the upper force that also envelops us, with its love. This has a completely different meaning. The day of love is not even a day but a state to which we come after destruction and problems. And when we turn to the Creator for help and with His help establish unity and love between us, this state continues forever. In the Mishnah it is written that on the 15th of Av the girls would put on white dresses and go out into the garden and sing and dance in circles, and the young men would come to choose their brides. However, we are not talking about young people but about aspirations of our soul, about the power of reception and the power of bestowal, which we must try to unite in order to come to their unification and the birth of a new world. If we want to achieve correction, we must unite the two opposite forces so that the force of reception and the force of bestowal work together and give birth to a new state, a new generation created by the union of the right and left, masculine and feminine principles. It is the woman who gives birth to a new state, a new generation, and leads to the correction of the world. The color white symbolizes the property of the upper force, full surrender, pure, good intention, and openness. And all this takes place in orchards where grapes and fruits ripen, which testifies to the renewal of life. Before this, we believed that we were living, but it was not life but continuous suffering. We considered it life only out of hopelessness. But now we really understand what life of love, union, and devotion to each other and the Creator is. And now we all unite with each other and with the upper force into one whole, one Kli, and then we really feel that we are beginning to live. Everyone is looking for the opportunity to bestow, to get closer, to love, to give to everyone impartially, without any boundaries. So we come to the union from which a new life is born, from two forces, right and left, a third is born, the middle line, which opens the heavens to us, and allows us, to see life at a perfect spiritual level. From CAP TV's The World, July 20, 2021. My new article on LinkedIn, The Danger in Our False Perception. Today, when we look at the world, we see only one force, egoism. We think that everything runs only according to everyone's efforts to raise themselves to the top of the heap, to be the hunter and not the hunted, the predator and not the prey. We, humanity, have reached the top of the pyramid, and from the zenith, we're trying to find what more we can take. To achieve this, we learn, become more sophisticated, and develop technology, science, social structures, and everything we have developed in order to succeed in this world. If we continue on our selfish trend, the horrible summer we are experiencing throughout the world will be the best summer of the rest of our lives. We don't have to continue on this route, have another option, to bury the hatchet and make peace with nature and with one another, and realize that we don't have to fight to win a good life, we only need to work together. But now that we've achieved all that, we find that something is still amiss. We realize that we have gone too far. We have taken egoism to the extreme, and we have destroyed our planet. Instead of supporting us, our own home is caving in on us, releasing torrential rains that flood entire countries, bursting in flames that incinerate titanic forests, and launch ash to the highest levels of the atmosphere. Siberia's frozen lands, once thought to be lifeless, are melting and discharging viruses and bacteria for which our immune system has no antibodies. And the animal kingdom, which we believed we had subdued, is infesting us with viruses and other bugs that arrest our entire global activity. With the heyday behind us, and the threat of nature's vengeance ahead, we seem to have one choice: stop trying to dominate nature and start cooperating with it. This is the time to realize that nature isn't run solely by egoism, but rather by two forces, egoism and altruism, which balance each other out and generate the dynamic harmony that enables the creation of life and evolution. Now is the time for us to realize that there is no hatred in nature but acceptance and inclusion of everyone into a larger whole that, in turn, sustains all of life. If we develop a considerate, accepting approach to all of nature, including to all people, we will discover that this is how nature truly operates and we will be able to operate likewise. Currently, our own egoism hides the truth from us, since if we see reality for what it is, we will agree to relinquish egoism, and no egoist wants to be relinquished. Yet, if we continue on our selfish trend, the horrible summer we are experiencing throughout the world will be the best summer of the rest of our lives. We don't have to continue on this route, have another option, to bury the hatchet and make peace with nature and with one another, and realize that we don't have to fight to win a good life, we only need to work together. My new article on LinkedIn, How to Exit the Pandemic in a Split World. COVID-19 has split the world between those who strongly support the need for massive vaccination to tackle the pandemic, and those who vehemently oppose mandatory inoculation and restrictions, taking to the streets of Europe and America to express their discontent. As the Delta variant spreads across the world, in the US alone, an average of 43,000 new cases are reported every day, a 65% increase in 1 week. How can we ever exit the pandemic in such a divided scenario? It is written, I dwell among my own people, 2 Kings 4:13a statement that means, I am part of the society I live among, and I share the public's frame of mind. If the vaccine is acceptable to most people and recommended by health officials, then I must go out and get vaccinated. I do not disengage from the people and do not consider myself more of an expert than the experts. This is how I chose and will continue to choose to act, and I will certainly not determine choices for my acquaintances or students, nor do I have the authority to do so. Every person is free to make an independent decision, and I respect and accept with great love each one and the choices everyone makes. It makes sense that there are concerns and objections, anxiety from the unknown and fears from the risks of failure, and other doubts arising from people involved in the medical field. Such voices have been heard and have resonated in the public space from the day the plague broke out. However, we will not come to a unanimous conclusion from within this swirl of endless rumors. The sages wrote to us, in black and white about a spiritual law. It was taught in the school of Rabbi Ishmael about the verse, He shall cause him to be thoroughly healed, Ex. 21:19. From this we learn that permission has been given to the physician to heal. Babylonian Talmud, Berakhot, 60a. The supreme force of nature heals through a representative within society, the doctor. It is true that today's medicine has fundamental flaws. This is also true about every other system we have built, because when the relationships between human beings are broken and the connections between us are selfish, society itself is broken. Naturally, this breakdown also affects the systems themselves. And yet, despite all the negative and positive things that are part of the medical field, it is nature acting through it in order to heal. Medicine is neither better nor worse than the human beings who rely on it. Doctors are not angels and the health systems are not heaven, but with all the shortcomings that we have, the medical situation is still the service we need. In other words, current spoiled medicine dresses like a glove on our spoiled society. If we were better, then we would be healed from this COVID plague by more natural forces, or we would find more creative solutions. But we are not corrected. Everyone can see that humanity is a society that is eating itself from within. People behave badly towards each other. We are locked within ourselves with self-interested calculations, ignoring the fact that we are not alone, that we are all connected and interdependent. So unfortunately, we cannot wait for a cure until everything within human society works properly. In the meantime, we have to recover from such diseases, and the available solutions are addressed in matter, in chemistry, in vaccines. If we make a change for the better in society, if we become a more supportive, loving, considerate, close, healthy society, then physical medicine will also change for the better. But it will never happen the other way around. Medicine will not change for the better until we change. Then, in every area and every situation in our lives, when we become more corrected, our world will also be more corrected. The plagues will disappear, the air will be cleansed, the water will clear, volcanoes will calm down, hurricanes and other hard forces will subside. It all depends on our inner state, on our relationships with one another. Michael Leitman, on Quora, why is so much of the world's food bad in quality? Our food cannot be of a good and natural sort because we strive to feed the entire world, billions of people. As a result, We are compelled to develop different genetic forms so that our food will not spoil quickly, and despite being separated from nature, will taste similar to natural food. This is why most of our food contains different genetic additives, and much of its flavors and smells are artificial. As a result of this, we also observe an accelerated growth of the new generation. Why does it grow so fast, with different deviations, and differ so much from the previous generation? It is because we eat food with several genetic additives and alterations. On the other hand, however, unfortunately we have no other solution. We are obliged to act in such a way in order to feed and deliver unspoiled food to billions of people. We have no way out until humanity will change its approach to life, so that we will take more care of ourselves, of the value of our lives instead of pursuing how to increase our earnings through so much of our activities. We will then be able to stop genetics from participating in the preparation of our food. Precisely the transformation of human consciousness from egoism to the general benefit of society will also lead to changes in the area of preparing delicious and healthy food. As usual, the human ego is the root of the problem in terms of the food we eat, and also the unhealthy, harmful and toxic products so many of us advertise to each other. Behind such activity is the desire to profit at the expense of others. Based on a Q&A with Kabbalist Dr. Michael Leitman on September 9, 2006. Written, edited by students of Kabbalist Dr. Michael Leitman. My new article on LinkedIn, Where is Our Survival Instinct? Which is stronger? The survival instinct or the hunting instinct? In the animal kingdom, this question is simple. The survival instinct overshadows all other instincts and fully dominates the behavior of animals. When there is a forest fire, natural enemies flee side by side and do not touch each other. Their survival instinct suppresses their hunting instincts, and everyone understands that now is the time to run. The time for hunting will come only once the immediate danger is gone. With humans, things get a little trickier. We want to survive, but we also want to dominate, to rule. In many cases, we want it more than life itself. Think of the risks people take for fame, how they risk themselves and, mainly, others in the battlefield, and you will see that for humans, life comes second when fame or power are concerned. We use any opportunity to trample them on our way to the top of the heap. When a common danger threatens people, there will always be those who take advantage of the fact that people are busy fleeing from the danger and are unaware of the danger lurking for them from other people. It does not have to be a physical danger. People may take advantage of natural disasters to make a fortune out of other people's misery. Even in the midst of this pandemic, countries and corporations are taking advantage of their technological and economic powers to profiteer at the expense of others. It is obvious that this attitude will turn against them, since any place where the virus can spread will eventually become a source of a new strain, but governments cannot see beyond their immediate profit, and all of us suffer as a result. This callous exploitation is human nature, and the sooner we acknowledge it, the sooner we can begin to change it. If we don't, the future blows, the outcomes of our misconduct toward each other will still teach us how to be considerate, but the lessons will be far more painful and costly both economically and in human lives. Either way, we will eventually learn that in a connected reality, where everyone depends on everyone else, nothing can be more senseless than to act selfishly. Our sages, who realized that we are interdependent thousands of years ago, wrote about it in the Jerusalem Talmud. In Masechet Nedarim, 9:4, they write, "Suppose one is cutting meat, and the knife descends into his hand, would he consider avenging his hand and cutting his other hand for cutting the first? So is this matter. The rule is that one does not take revenge against one's neighbor, for it is as though he is taking revenge against his own body." A meal, receiving the upper abundance. Question: what is the spiritual root of a meal? Answer: a meal is a great action. Even the fact that animals feed together indicates that they are getting closer together and trust each other. Even more so for people who are much more cunning and further apart from each other. When they sit at the table together, or one invites the other, or both have a meal together, it indicates that they have the intention to get closer at least temporarily. Therefore, for all nations, all cultures, a meal is a certain connection between people no matter how many, 2, 3, or even up to 1,000. On the other hand, we know from Kabbalistic sources that when it comes to coming closer together, to connection, to something joyful, or even not quite joyful but especially solemn and significant, there is always a meal arranged. In Kabbalah, a meal represents receiving the upper abundance from the Creator. Since He is the source of all living things, all intake of food is associated with turning to the Creator. Therefore, before the meal, during the meal, and after the meal, it is customary to turn to the Creator with a special appeal so that the very connection of people with everything that surrounds and is included in the meal will have a good result, a success. Therefore, we always arrange a meal when we are happy, even not very happy, that is, when we want to celebrate a special state. However, usually the meal symbolizes something cheerful and pleasant. For example, a meal in honor of a child being born, his 13th birthday, an engagement, a wedding, and so on. In general, meals accompany us, in all good times. However, even if a person dies, his relatives also arrange a meal. Of course, it is no longer solemn, not cheerful, but still, it is necessary to pay tribute to the deceased. From Cab TV's Spiritual States, July 9, 2021. Do planets control our fate? Question: should I study sciences like astrology and the impact of the moon in order to plan the future? Answer: Kabbalah teaches that celestial bodies and many other things are only indicators of the impact of the upper forces on us. Certain forces control the motion of the planets and thus impact our fate. And we, by the movement of the planets, think that it is actually the force that influences us, let's say, the moon. No. It is the upper force that controls the moon. Therefore, by studying Kabbalah, we gain access to the real upper force that manages our fate and not the lifeless celestial bodies. By themselves, they do nothing. It is said that Kabbalists are above the stars. That is, they deal with the source of the light, the upper force that manages the celestial and the earthly actions, objects and phenomena, and so it seems to us that they determine our fate. This mistake stems from the past and goes back to the pharaohs with their pyramids and priests. From Cab TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, April 28, 2019. What helps to uncover the slant serpent? The Book of Zohar, concerning the verse, "Let there be light," it is written in the books of the first that it is the slant serpent, who always moves in curves and brings curses to the world because he seduced Eve with the tree of knowledge. Question: why is it said that the slant serpent moves in curves? Answer: otherwise, it would not crawl into Adam and Eve. Through Eve, the serpent must crawl into Adam and thus perform its work so that the world becomes ready for correction. After all, before man was bitten by the snake, he was like an angel walking in the Garden of Eden. There was nothing wrong with him, everything was fine. He played the lute there, listened to the singing of angels, and everything around was syrupy sweet. In order to raise a person to the level of the Creator, it is necessary that he discovers serious, great egoism in himself, how much he is really poisoned by it, how much he is opposite to the Creator. This analysis is done by the serpent. He reveals the egoism that is sitting in a person, but is not seen or felt, and therefore, he cannot correct himself. Thus, at the very beginning of creation, Action with the serpent is necessary. From CAB TV's The Power of the Book of Zohar, number 16. How can we distinguish between egoistic desires and altruistic desires? Question from Facebook: how can we distinguish between egoistic desires that I have and altruistic desires? Very often the ego takes on different forms, so it is difficult to understand whether my thoughts and actions are predetermined. Answer: altruism is different from egoism only in the fact that you want to be in good relations with others in order to attain the Creator by this good connection. There are no other definitions. Everything else besides the small connection in the group that is aimed at attaining the resemblance to the Creator according to the principle "love thy friend as thyself" is egoism. Question: is altruism good or bad? Answer: altruism is the desire to do everything for another person, to determine what he lacks and to fill this deficiency. From CAB TV's Answering Questions from Facebook, March 10, 2019.